everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, a look at the history of the creation of Saudi Arabia, its role in current geopolitics, the U.S.-Saudi relations that are destabilizing the Middle East, and why the Saudi kingdom is still favored by most of the members of our Congress, most of the mainstream media, and yet it has been proven, not just with Freedom of Information Act documents, not just from the 20 pages from the 9/11 group, but also WikiLeaks, that it has been sponsoring terrorism, including terrorism used against the United States and its allies, for a long time. What is this standard, this double standard? So we're going to explore this. My guest from Washington, D.C. is Ali Al-Ahmed. He is a Saudi scholar. He's an expert in Saudi Arabia's political affairs, including the history of the Saudi royal family and Islamic movements, Wahhabism, and Saudi-American foreign relations and the repressive social and political conditions in the kingdom. He is a founder and current director at the Institute for Gulf Affairs in Washington, D.C., which is a nonpartisan institute that analyzes the political climate throughout the Gulf area. Ali has been an invited speaker at Princeton, Amnesty International, the Hudson Institute, and other prestigious institutions. He has also consulted for CBS, CNN, PBS, Fox, and other major networks. He holds degrees in journalism and a master's degree in international finance from St. Thomas University, Minnesota. And the Institute's website is gulfinstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Ali.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
I'd like to begin by picking up on some of the history behind the rise of the Saud royal family, which was only one among many Arab tribes on the Arabian Peninsula, and they're coming to absolute rule with the assistance of the British. And after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, there was a complete alteration of the Middle East by European powers. It was also true in Syria, which was a harmonious region of independent provinces, each with its own particular religious and ethnic majorities, interacting together before the French tried to unify them into a single country. What was Britain's geopolitical motivation for selecting the Saud tribe to align with? And let's speak a little about how the rise of monarchy is actually a contradiction to Islamic doctrine. Please take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much for having me. The Saudi monarchy or clan has a long history in the Arabian Peninsula, and it started with it was a small family that controlled a small town in central Najd or central Arabia called Diriyya, and there Muhammad bin Saud, hence the Saudi state or Saudi Arabia, the name came from that. And the Saudi family was named because he is the founder of the political or the first ruler of the Saudi ruling family. That was in the 17th century. And this is where he met Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, and they decided the best way to gain power is to use religion. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab is the founder of Wahhabism. He was a person, they're both from the Najd region, which was completely isolated from the Muslim world since the beginning of Islam. And Najd was the center of resistance to Islam early on, and continued to do so, and it witnessed a brutal war between the successor or the first successor of the Prophet Muhammad and the Najdi population or region, who wanted also to provide their own form of religion. That war was devastating to both sides. But the Muslims, the followers of Muhammad, won against the Najdis. That area, 1,000 years later, basically came back and tried to cannot start its own religion, but it put a twist on the current dominant religion, which is Islam. The Wahhabi understanding of Islam really has a lot of contradiction with Islam itself. And I've written about it in hopefully my upcoming book, and how the actual doctrinal belief of the Wahhabi movement it contradicts most Muslims' beliefs vis-a-vis God, for example, and vis-a-vis the Prophet and the Quran and so on. So it's a main tenet of the religion, they contradict it. So here is the beginning of the time, and they use that religion, religious understanding, to wage war. You'll be surprised if I tell you the first invasion or attack was against Riyadh, which is at the time was a small town, and they killed dozens of its people, and they called them unbelievers, although they were Muslims, they were Sunni Muslims, in fact, not much different than they are. So Diriyya to the north attacked Riyadh to the south, and they continued to do these attacks. Arabia Peninsula was not ruled by one entity, so it was easy to attack these caravans, and especially a major target for the Wahhabi terrorists, really, at the time, was the Hajj caravans, the pilgrims who came from Iraq and Iran and India at the time, and camels in the 17th, 18th centuries to go to Mecca. They had a lot of wealth. So there's a lot of attack on those travelers. This is how the Saudis early on built their state, by stealing. In fact, in the 18th century, they went even to attack and raids Mecca and Medina, and they destroyed a lot of it, killed a lot of people, and raided the tomb of the Prophet Muhammad. This is not a behavior of a Muslim, to raid the tomb of your prophet and take its valuables. And that happened, and that drove, this was the first Saudi state, we call it, drove the Ottoman Empire at the time to decide to send an army to Diriyya and to finish off the state. And they did that. And of course, when the Arabian Peninsula, the central part of it, became lawless, The Saudi came back, and with the support of the British, they founded their state in the 19th century. In 1902, started with Abdul Aziz, the father of King Salman, being funded by the British, by William Percy Cox, the British representative who was based in Kuwait, and he covered the Arabian Peninsula. That was the Ottoman Empire's territory. So he wanted to basically break that empire. The British wanted to break the empire, and they supported certain people. Abdul Aziz, the Al Saud, provided these services, and they supported him against the pro-Ottoman Empire. They gave them weapons. They gave them even aerial support. In fact, one of the British generals, John Shakespeare, led the Saudi army, and he had a very trusted Abdul Aziz, that is, a British spy, Philippi, John Philippi, whose sons, Kim Philippi, became famous for being a Soviet spy. So the British were involved in establishing what we know today as Saudi Arabia. And you notice that the monarchy that you spoke about is a copy of the British monarchy. In the Arab culture, we did not have kings and titles of His Royal Highness, His Majesty, and this sort of class level, because it's anti-Islam. But these are copies of the British sort of system of a monarchy that you Americans, I want to remind the Americans that in America, in Boston, the Tea Party and the American Revolution actually just did that, destroyed the monarchy that was leading this land. So the British replicated their monarchy, their absolute monarchy at the time, in the Arab world, in Egypt, in Iraq, and in the Gulf. So today, the last remaining monarchies are in the Gulf. The British-made monarchy are in the Gulf and Jordan. So we'll see what happens with that. But this is really You have an absolute monarchy that uses a perverted explanation of Islam that contradicts Islam in many ways to dominate the region.
Ali, these are rather complex issues for a person who is not familiar with the history to understand. I want to break it down into some segments that may allow for an easier understanding. Because what we have done, we have conflated Islam, all of Islam, with one sect, and that is Wahhabism. Now, Wahhabism, Wahhabism, that is does not represent all of Islam. And yet, over the past 10 years or more, anytime we've heard about something that was some radical who decided to blow themselves up or kill other people or behead someone or create just mass graves and kill all the people within different villages, including all the majority of the people the ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda kill, are themselves Islamic. But for many people who are not familiar with the differences, they're then blaming all of Islam, and hence you get a lot of this Islamic phobia permeating the airwaves. Explain the difference between Iran, which is Shia, and there's very few countries that are actually Shia, as opposed to Sunnis. But even within Sunnis, not all Sunnis support Wahhabism. And so with respect to the relationship between the Saud tribe of Wahhabism, this relationship goes back to the 18th century when the Sauds became a patron of the radical and by many Muslims, a heretical teaching of the preacher Muhammad al-Wahhab. What were the events that led to Wahhabism becoming the state religion of Saudi Arabia and the Saudi kingdom? And then many of the terrorist organizations embraced the Salafi or Wahhabi theology. And Saudi Arabia sponsors more religious schools than any other person on the planet. He has thousands of these madrasas, and they only teach the most radical Salafi theology that fuels fundamentalist Islamic militancy. And so if the Sauds are the major supporters and funders of groups such as Al-Qaeda, and they are, what would be the reason that the United States, Great Britain, France, Italy, Germany has continued to give full support to the Saudi kingdom over the decades, and especially now that you have this young firebrand who seems to be a classical psychopath? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you. The reason that the British Empire at the time wanted you can call it an agent, that will weaken the Muslim. At the time, the British had the Ottoman Empire, huge land, and a religion that was able to basically meet the challenges. So in order to weaken that, you have to come up with different divisions within the religion. Wahhabism was one of them, and maybe the most successful, because the British helped the Wahhabis, the Al-Saud, take over Mecca and Medina. And it's very important because if you control what I call the heart of God, Mecca and Medina, the holiest cities for Muslims, and you have the pot of gold, that the oil, you can influence the course of Islam to create an Islam that is perverted. It's different. It's not the one that is originally revealed to stretch your interest. And this is exactly what happened. There is no surprise that the UK and the U.S., for that matter, support an absolute monarchy that is racist, that is against women, that is has produced extremism that hit the hearts of the United States and the U.K. and London. That is maybe intentional. There is an article in the New York Times by Mr. Faisal Divaji of the Cato Institute talking about that, from the University of Oxford and Cato Institute, talking about how the British thinkers thought that in order to defeat this Islamic or Muslim power, we need to install or promote a division And the Saudis provided that because they are geographically located in the heart of where Islam was born, Mecca and Medina, and use that Mecca and Medina to give a different Islam. And exactly what happened, Islam that built many sciences like algebra and physics and you know, and many things that you and medicine, now is an Islam of Saudi Islam is of oppression, of extremism, of hatred. And that is a strategic goal, and I think we need a departure of that. We need to, for the UK, for the United Kingdom and the United States, to rethink that support, because better Muslims or saner Muslims is better for the West than this brand of faith, Islam or not, that is affecting the brains of hundreds of millions of Muslims around the world, including in the United States. And I've seen the victims here, American-born, who were brainwashed by this ideology, that they turn against their own neighbors, try to kill them. And September 11 is a great example of that. And we need to start thinking a little bit of a moral, a moral policy than this opportunist, almost devilish way of thinking that in order to consider the Muslims our...
Ali, you and I both know that that's never going to happen. On this program, I do not deal in fantasy. I deal in reality. And our government is simply incapable of dealing honestly and ethically and morally for the benefit of all with any government in the world, let alone one of the most corrupt and one of the most vile, and that's Saudi Arabia. On that issue, do you have any knowledge of the truth behind Saudi Arabia's support for the terrorists on 9/11? Since the President of the United States, Barack Obama, did everything in his power to prevent that information from being released, it took an act of Congress for that to be released, and he vetoed that act, and they overrode his veto, so that the victims would know the truth. Now think, just let's stop for a moment and wrap our minds around this. We had, by many concern, the most devastating modern event, a terrorist event in American history, and nearly 2,000 dead, enormous amount of suffering, and everyone that could be associated with it in any way would be brought to justice. But the people who are now proven to have been behind this and financing and planning, are there's not a word in the New York Times about this and holding them culpable. Bandar, who was the ambassador, as well as at that time, I think he was the head of the Saudi Secret Services, what would be their security services. And yet he was close friend with the Bushes. And the Bushes allowing the Saudis and no other country citizens to leave. All Saudis were given free passage with no interrogation out of the United States. That's unheard of. And yet, knowing who some of the principals are has received no attention from the left, nor the right, nor the media. And you can't even get a conversation on alternative media about this. What do you know?
I know is definitely the Saudis had a role in terms of raising these soldiers, these terrorists, through the education system, through their religious ideology, the state-sanctioned ideology. Unfortunately, in the Middle East, in the Arab countries especially, we have state religion, and that should end because it has had a negative effect on the population. And if Saudi Arabia continues to have Wahhabism as its state religion, you will continue to have extremists. You will continue to have terrorists who will attack you or attack other people. The United States, after September 11, I thought will take it and make sure that this issue is resolved by stopping or pressuring the Saudis to stop using Wahhabism as a state religion. We cannot fight a religious ideology, but at least we can do is stopping it from becoming the state religion of a country. And that should have happened. In fact, One of the things I worked on is I profiled the September 11 hijackers. I was the first one to do it. And those people who recruited them are still alive and free. Those people who gave the network that gave rise to the thousands of Saudi terrorists, including the September 11 hijackers, remains operational and remains free. The United States, clear to me in many years of working in D.C., does not want to deal with this issue. What was the reason? I'm not sure. I can, think or guess, but reality is the belief in the West is, even now after the killing of Mr. Khashoggi, we have no alternative to the Saudi monarchy. There is almost a holy belief that the only option here is to have this family ruling that country. No other options. The people of that country do not get mentioned in any statement you hear, even those who are critical of the Saudi monarchy and MBS. And that is wrong, because especially from Americans, Americans who have in this country removed an absolute monarchy and built a republic of the people, for the people, by the people. That is something the people of my country deserve as well, and they can make that choice for themselves.
Are you familiar with our articles of the original founding fathers' original writings, like James Madison, and when before the signing of the Declaration of Independence, there were not a lot of people who signed it, 13 people refused to. Are you aware that these Articles of Confederation, these people did not believe that there was going to be a government that could be trusted, a government that would not usurp power to itself? All you have to do is read those earlier statements and you realize that what they were doing was trying to put into place a constitution and Bill of Rights that would prevent government's overreach, and everything that they feared has come true today. We have a person in office today and surrounded by people like him, the sycophants. Take a look at him, and now take a look at the ruler of Saudi Arabia, the absolute ruler. He's 32 years old, and unlike all other traditions where the ascension goes from the father who dies to the brothers, this went to a brother's son. Now, that's very unusual, and the person who was the rightful heir was thrown aside, his own cousin, and then he had six of those cousins arrested, including the wealthiest person in Saudi Arabia. And the information I've received, and I do not know if it's accurate or not, but it does come from a very good source, says that one reason he did this was not simply because he wanted to make sure that he had absolute power, and he was going to throw the fear into all of the people in the royal court. He would become the head of everything, every department. But he also was running out of money. For the first time in their history, they had to go borrow money. They started opening up for cash because they were burning through billions, tens of billions of dollars in Yemen. And all of his other efforts were for naught, a stupid effort to try to destroy and overturn Qatar. But he got $800 billion from all the people, including his own cousins. And in an interview, a very brilliantly done interview with the former top person who is loved by Wall Street because he invests in all the startup capital is needed in Silicon Valley. He's provided billions, and banks that were failing, he jumped in. Well, now in this interview, the guy asked him, "Do you still own any of your own companies?" He wouldn't answer it. He said, "Well, my name is still on that company." "No, that's not what I'm asking you. Do you have any money left? The fact that your name may still be associated with a corporation doesn't mean the shares in that corporation that you owned. We understand that virtually all your money, all your assets, as well as all of the other people arrested, over 1,000 people, by the way, and all other assets were confiscated, totaling $800 billion. So now, if that's true, or some high percentage of that, this is the man who has the capacity financially to carry on the Yemen war as long as he wants now. And yet that's never discussed. No one in the media, you haven't seen it on the New York Times or CNN what actually happened to all the money without trial and torture. They tortured him in the Ritz-Carlton. Isn't that an oxymoron? You get, I guess, a six-star torture in an eight-star hotel. But they were tortured, they were beaten, they were threatened, they were strangled. All this, I hear, went on from very good sources. So now here's the man that the President of the United States says, but we've got to do business with him. And most of Congress agrees, the entire Wall Street community agrees, the entire military-industrial complex agrees. The whole cesspool that you are unfortunately speaking from, Washington, D.C., and you know this as well, I do, they want that relationship. They don't give a damn about this one single guy. And by the way, I'm rather disappointed. Since when does this journalist, who was not a person who believed in freedoms and democracy, even though he worked for the Washington Post, that worthless rag, but why is his death so important, and yet the death of a gay being thrown off a building, or a woman who was asking for peace with the Shia in her own country beheaded, and the women who, 22 women who campaigned for women to be given the right to drive without being accompanied in the car by a male relative, every single one of them is in prison. Why are these sufferings, these beheadings, not as significant and newsworthy as this one guy, who, when I look at his background, I wouldn't invite this guy to anything? Your thoughts, please.
To say that I'm familiar with the early American constitutional writings, and in my college years, I took upon myself, I flew to Boston from Minnesota with a tea bag with me, and I walked that Freedom Trail. And I walked and I took that tea with me and I dumped it in the harbor. And I did in 2004, was lucky to have given a speech in Faneuil Hall, where I was invited to give a speech by Penn New England on freedom of expression in Faneuil Hall, where the Declaration of Independence was read and announced. So I'm familiar, and I think that inspired me to think that I think this my country can do the same. And I agree with you that the U.S. government is becoming more like the Saudi government. We were hoping that our government would be a little bit more than like the American government. So, and that has to do with corruption and bad money and dirty money, that the United States is susceptible to foreign influence from absolute governments, including the Chinese and the Saudis and even other small Gulf countries. The reality is, you know, Mr. Khashoggi's murder, and I agree that he was not completely a journalist. He did not believe in many things that the media is saying that he does. That does not justify his murder. If his a murder is going to change American policy, I hope it does, and to make American policy much more moral and responsible and more realistic, in fact, because what is the Saudi government has done to the U.S. has made the U.S. a worse place, not a better place, for its people and for even for this government. This 9/11 and what happened after 9/11 is hurting America. And Saudi Arabia provided everything, the environment and the funding and the networks for it to happen, made it possible. If there was no Saudi Arabia, there would not be September 11th. I think this is an opportunity to rethink the Saudi monarchy. In historical view, there was the American Revolution that brought upon the French Revolution. Then I think now is the third time we need it for the Muslim world, for this place of importance where Islam was born, to have some kind of a change that we can equate to the American and French Revolution in its impact on societies and freedoms of expression and modern life, because we need to modernize our way of thinking in our part of the world. So we can have freedoms for all, regardless of their background.
I agree with that. Well said. Thank you. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is the 1 hour a week that I do on one theme, very serious topic, and bring the world's finest minds on that topic to share their insights. My guest from Washington, D.C. on Skype is Ali Ahmed. He is a Saudi scholar. He is an expert in Saudi Arabia's political affairs and their history, especially the Saud family and Islamic movements, Wahhabism, and Saudi-American foreign relations. And now I want to go to what's at the heart of this. Because outside of rising oil prices and how Saudi Arabia for decades have controlled the price of oil, there are many other members of OPEC, of course, but what goes on in Saudi Arabia has a major influence. So if they want to hold back oil, the price goes up. If they want to flood the market with more, price goes down. And a lot of people in the between speculate on this. But we have not known a lot about a single ruler. And we have not known a lot about their personal lives. But now we have one that casts a completely different shadow over Saudi Arabia and Yemen. He is young, he is inexperienced, and he has alienated virtually everyone in the royal family. It is surprising to me that there has not been, with all the people he has taken their assets and their money and is ruthless, and especially the assassination of this person, that there has been a coup against him. There probably will be, because from what I understand, he has made enemies within the military at every level, and yet he made himself head of the military. Here's my question, Ali. I have been posting articles on my Facebook page almost daily about the suffering in Yemen. I've done programs on it, about how you have the largest cholera epidemic in the world, you have the most starvation that we've seen since probably the 1970s with droughts in Ethiopia and the Sudan. We have 19 million people in the poorest country in the Middle East who are malnourished. Over 100,000 children, by a realistic measure, have died already. We know, because the United States supported with military boots on the ground, all the planes and weapons, munitions, and satellite, that they have been bombing against all conventions, including the Geneva Convention, infrastructure important to civilian life. For example, you're not allowed, if you're fighting a war with someone, to bomb their hospitals, their markets, their libraries, power plants that are necessary for generating water. Now, Bill Clinton did it, and we got the Freedom of Information Act to prove that the Defense Department knew that there would be about 500,000 died. It's now up to about 640,000 children died. And the idea was, and the Clintons, Hillary and Bill, were both sponsoring this, if we make it bad enough on the citizens of Iraq, they'll rise up against the ruler, throw him out, and that's it. It didn't happen. Now, I can assure you that the ruler of Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, but no one was held accountable. His army of 60,000 personal, warriors all had purified water, plenty to eat. The average citizen didn't. And as a result, at least 500,000 died. Now imagine placing that same scenario in Yemen, except now it's not about getting rid of a person. It's about taking over a whole country. But look at the death and the destruction and the violation of every single international law. And yet you don't see this condemned. You don't see CNN embedded in Yemen. The United States is supporting the blockade. Last week, there was a signing of a ceasefire. And yet, immediately, Trump stopped the ceasefire so the carnage could continue. So my question, therefore, is why is Yemen so important for Saudi Arabia? What is the U.S. gaining for its permitting this genocide, and it is genocide, to continue? And is there anything the mainstream media is not telling us about the geopolitical importance of Yemen to the Gulf states? Because the United Arab Emirates, which is seven separate groups, all really under one control, they have their own, each one of those seven has their own ruler, but there's one that's dominant. But they're also involved in this, and the United Kingdom's involved in it, and Israel's involved in it. So could you make sense to our audience of why Yemen, why destroy it, why commit genocide, and why isn't the media doing a damn thing about it?
Yemen is the basically the poorest country in the Arab-speaking world. And the UK and the US strategic policy has been that they do not want a country to be outside the control of their policy, direct policy. And when the Arab Spring happened, in Yemen, the balance of power shifted, and the Obama administration, carrying on its lead from behind, they got the Saudis and the Gulf monarchies to try to set up basically a new regime, because the Saleh regime basically has expired, and they needed a new regime with new arrangement in Yemen to continue the dominance over the Yemeni people. And the Yemeni people typically are very independent because they live in the mountainous region. And what had happened, a section of that society took over the government because there was a political gridlock. And they realized that the Saudis and the Americans behind them were trying to create a regime that is, a puppet of the Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia has dominated Yemen and became involved in its politics, killing the most popular president in 1978, Mr. Ibrahim al-Hamdi, at the hand of no other than Ali Abdullah Saleh, who became Saudi Arabia's agent. For many years, for 33 years, he led the Yemen, and he was friends with the Saudis and also the Americans. When that changed, when the revolution took him out, they wanted to bring somebody else because Ali Abdullah Saleh has expired, and that was Mr. Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. When that agreement basically expired, there was a vacuum. The so-called Houthis or Ansarullah took power, and in hoping to unify the country and start something inclusive. The Saudis didn't want that, and they decided to go to war, and the Americans and the British knew about it and actually approved it. I can tell you that with full confidence that the Obama administration and the British government knew ahead of time and approved ahead of time this war, which is, you know, the longest bombing campaign ever in the Middle East, killed hundreds of thousands of people. The UN has stopped publishing those numbers, and the international media, including the American media, is using old numbers of 10,000. The numbers of children who died either from bombing or disease or starvation is over 100,000. This is the largest number of killing children in the past decade. Yet it does not make it to this media. The suffering is great. The Yemeni people, and almost the entire Yemeni people, are under siege and under starvation and disease. As you said, this is the largest humanitarian catastrophe of our time. And the Americans and the British and the Saudis obviously are doing it intentionally. And the reason is, again, is just the American arms companies making money, and the same thing with the British. They view the death of these children as, you know, a marginal thing. They don't. I think it has to do with bigotry, to be frank with you, because if these children were European children, this is not would be the same feeling that we can let this happen and we don't do anything about it. The U.S. and the U.K. can stop this war tomorrow. If they said to the Saudis, look, you have to stop, they will stop. The problem is they are speaking with both sides of their mouth. They are saying, oh, we are concerned, we don't want this. At the same time, they are providing weaponry and targeting. And there are private British pilots that are flying some of those planes that are bombing the Yemeni people. And the American bombs, like Bernie Sanders talked about it today, You can see those American bombs, the fragments with the names of American companies written on them, killing children and civilians. And so really, this is a useless war that's not going to help anybody, including the Saudis, who have lost a lot of money. And it's obviously the Yemeni people have suffered greatly. There is a problem in Yemen. It should be solved through negotiation. And the Americans and the Russians and other world powers can make it happen if they want to. There are no needs for more wars and bombs. Americans can make money building countries, not bombing them.
Oh, we make far more bombing them than bring in Halliburton and Bechtel and rebuild them at 500% profit. It's called cost plus. In recent years, and going back to Obama that you just mentioned's administration, we've seen this new triumvirate alliance emerge between the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. Now, seemingly, this is because both the Saudis and Israel view Iran as a number one threat. I do not. And as you probably know, Israel has already made efforts to destabilize Iran through cyber warfare. And there was the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. I believe 6 were assassinated. And then a cyber attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, and where they got a virus in that created a hyperagitation of the centrifuges, so they exploded. Iran thought that this was something wrong with their equipment. And yet it's been shown repeatedly with visits and 24/7 security cameras in every single nuclear facility, and inspections constantly, that there is no effort to make a nuclear bomb. And yet they keep playing this card as if we should all be frightened and therefore go along with a preemptive attack. Now, one of those cyber attacks, the United States, the National Security Agency, and Israel worked together on, and that was the virus that would cause the destruction of their centrifuges. But there was another virus found, and by 2 American experts, cyber security experts, and it led right back to Israel. And this one was to turn off all the electricity in the country. So you would have to ask, why turn off all the electricity in Iran? Well, if you look at how long it would take a plane to fly from Israel to Iran and then bomb it and then back, those were always considered suicide flights, because they didn't figure they would be able to make it back. They would be the radar and interceptions, etc. But if you turned off all the electricity, there would be no communications, no satellite, no reconnaissance, no defense mechanisms. Now, here's what we don't talk about, and we should. Once Iran found out that there was a virus that could turn off all their electricity in the country, not just air conditioners. Think of what it would do if it was a hot day and you were in a hospital and you're in the desert. After all, in the last year, 2 of the hottest days on the planet, one was in Iran. But now that they have found this out, China, Russia, and Iran have started this massive cyber prevention program, and I cannot imagine that they have not all three put into effect an aggressive cyber program. And if that's the case, then any type of war in between Iran and Saudi Arabia, Iran and Israel, or any combination, it is impossible for anyone to win that war. Iran is not a small little country. It's got almost more population than any other country in the Middle East. Arab country, it's got 82 million people. It has a highly educated group. And they've been planning, with over 1 million people in their armed forces, they've been planning to be attacked. So they're not going to be completely vulnerable. And the likelihood is that they would be going in and then doing enormous damage to the infrastructure of Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, any of the other countries, Jordan, that would support an attack against them. And this is not on anyone's talking points. No one is discussing this. And yet, if Hillary Clinton had become president, I can promise you that that would have been one of the highest priorities, is to green light Israel going in and taking out Iran. That wouldn't be easy, and they would probably have to use nuclear to do it. But I don't trust anyone in the Middle East to do anything that is sensible or reasonable since we're dealing with so many emotionally, in my opinion, emotionally unstable people. Now we've got one of the most emotionally unstable, and this fellow there who's running the Saudi government, and now wants nuclear. And people in the United States think, yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, but let's give Prince Mohammed bin Salman nuclear so he can defend himself. I can't believe what I'm hearing coming out of Washington. Your thoughts on each of these points, please.
Yes, Iran is a very important country. You might not like their government. I don't personally like the government. But Iran is an important country in our region. And we had enough wars. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries pushed Saddam to wage war, aggression against the Iranians, killing at least a million people and destroying both countries and using chemical weapons. And that was done during the Reagan administration. And that war, that eight-year war, destroyed both countries and the region, because our money that we could have spent on building schools and hospitals, we spent it on bombing each other. I think it's time to change that policy. And I promise you, American companies will make much more money with stable, democratic countries that are trying to build their infrastructure than bombing those countries and making those countries poorer. It's not a black and white game. We can win both sides, make those countries better and make the United States better. And that's why you have relations with the your economic influence, the American influence, is you have your business with the Germans and the Japanese because they have great economies. That's what we need to do in our region. It's true that Iran's, I think, fault with the fault that the U.S. and the U.K. finds with Iran is, regardless of its form of government or its policies, it is independent. And why would they be against Iran, which is a theocracy, and support Saudi Arabia, which is an absolute monarchy that uses an extreme form of religion? It's because the Saudi government beckons to Washington and London. The Tehran government does not. That is the problem with the Americans and the British find with the Iranians. It's not their domestic or foreign policy, for that matter. It is their independence from these two capitals. Because of that, they are putting this alliance of the Saudis and other Gulf countries and Israel to undermine everything in Iran, from electricity to medication right now, which is horrible. This is an American. I don't think it's part of the American values to withhold medicine from anyone. Does not even from the Nazis, for that matter, because we have at least a minimum a red line of humanity that we should never cross. So food and medicine is something we will never target. We will never withhold from animals.
But we have, let alone human beings. Well, Ali, we've withheld it in Yemen. I mean, that's the United States. The United States is responsible for that blockade, not just Saudi Arabia. So we're engaged in genocide right now. A very important issue that is not discussed is the personality and what motivates this Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Just today, the CIA director, Gina Haspel, met with senators, a small select group of senators, who are convinced that the prince was directly involved in overseeing the assassination of Khashoggi. Now, mind you, she's the head of the CIA, but they evidently had a direct line of people from the National Security Agency that did the original recording of the phone call that showed the prince telling his brother that he must die. And then there's another person whose phone was tapped out of Israel who was a friend of Khashoggi. So what do you know about Prince Mohammed bin Salman that would allow us to better understand all of his motives? And isn't it rather ironic that we are quick and should immediately condemn the violence that occurs, but we have not condemned them based upon the 9/11 attacks, and they were participants in the financing and in the education of the people through the madrasas. We do not condemn him when he comes to the United States and meets with Bill Gates and Bloomberg and executives in Silicon Valley, including Mark Zuckerberg. So when someone manages to receive the best wishes from America's corporate elite, that can go a long way to protect their public image later, especially in the Trump administration, which is all about corporate revenues and profits rather than morals and ethics, which are virtually non-existent. So give us your perspective in the last part of our last question here on the prince.
I was the first to write what you can call a profile of Mohammed bin Salman in 2016. And based on information obtained from his cousins and other people in the government, and even people who have seen him when he was young, they describe him as a very aggressive individual with like a loner with deep-seated anger. In fact, we did a report this past year about him, committing domestic violence against his wife, the mother of his children, and his cousin. She was hospitalized several times. He threw his own mother under house arrest, his own brother as well. This is before the killing of Mr. Khashoggi. And this gives you an indication of what kind of a person he is. He is a violent man. And who do not tolerate people's disagreement with him. And he acts swiftly, and that's why he's able to rise very quickly through basically the strongest Saudi leader of all time, because he uses violence and bullying as a tactic. And he was able, and this has been actually positive for him, because he's able now to become the only, the head of everything, the man to beat in the country, with collecting hundreds of billions of dollars under his control and usurping the entire Saudi state under his control. So that his style has since he was young. And now that he is the de facto ruler, he's continued to do that, to practice the same behavior, and that is what drove him to continue to wage war in Yemen, continue to do so in total disregard to humanity. Blocked the or arrested and kidnapped the prime minister of Lebanon because he could, and no one spoke or did anything against him. I don't know of any foreign leader kidnapping an elected leader of a government and getting away with it. It's unheard of, but he got away with it because American and British and French support.
And he also told, this is amazing, he told the president to resign. And so he went to Saudi Arabia and resigned and then was allowed to leave the country. And that did not cause people concern?
Cause anybody to say anything? Or where is the United Nations? Supposedly the United Nations supposed to have some kind of influence in terms of protecting heads of state from such practice.
I have no respect. Let me just, Ali, I cannot stand the UN. It is completely, totally corrupt. Members of my radio audience have been very high up officials at the UN. I have spoken with them. They have told me what goes on. The CIA is in every single office there. Every single thing is monitored. And remember, when the Canadian general, who was the head of the UN mission in a genocide zone just prior before it became genocide in Rwanda, he knew where the warehouse where all the weapons and machetes were being stored and were going to be used, and he was going to go raid it and stop it. He was told, step down, stand down. Then he knew that he could rescue some Italian soldiers, and he was told to stand down. Then Belgium soldiers, 10 of them, he was told to stand down. And then the final straw came when the Hutu would bring the Tutsi women in a circle and then spend the whole day whacking him with machetes right in front of the UN mission, and he had his soldiers stand down because he was told, stand down. And then when the 2,200 plus men, women, and children were in the Catholic Church, and I think it was either the Italian I think it was the Italian soldiers were the last guarding them. And so they said, we're pulling out. And so he was to go in there and protect them, and he was told, stand down. And so the soldiers under the UN watched as every single man, woman, and child was machete killed. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. You've been listening to Ali Ahmed from Washington, D.C., and his website is gulfinstitute.org, and he is doing a lot of work to educate us about the truth of Saudi Arabia. Have a nice day, everyone.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up? This is a good recording, man.
Yeah, brother,
I dig it.
Stop right on.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.